This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by the things we make. If you want to support Gregory Kamichuk, you can go to gmbkamichuk.ca. And if you think Justin Curry is just all right, you can go to chasingartwork.com.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my long-suffering producer, Dan Vadebunker, our co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork, is away in a secret location.
We don't want to say where he is.
No, okay. Secured in a hotel room many miles from here. While his significant other attends their day job, he decided to sequester himself, took his entire art rig, his Cintiq, his hard drives, his everything, and he is living, on, as far as I know, living on room service and working around the clock.
He's just living off of those little mints they live on the pillow.
I think so. They come in, they brush him off. From crumbs, they leave a mint on his pillow.
That's
and
fine.
They leave. So he is not here today, but we don't need him, Dan.
You sure?
It's you and me. Yes, because you've got the best radio voice of all three of us anyway.
All right, sure, let's do it. What are we going to talk about?
Something that's your fault.
Oh, yes. I guess my fault, but it's a good thing, right?
So
that implies that it would be a bad thing, but I think this is a good thing. You were recently involved with Gametoba. Let's talk about that.
So, yeah, January 27th, 28th, 29th, I went to Gametoba. We should actually roll back the calendar a little bit.
Talk about why it's my fault?
Yeah, how to place blame on Dan.
All right.
Which is really a producer's role, is to be blamed for things. But in this case, you posted on your social media, you know, has anyone ever heard of Gametoba? If you don't know about Gametoba, you should, and check it out. And so, based on that, I was like, well, I literally make tabletop role-playing games. How have I not heard of Gametoba? I felt so ashamed. They hadn't happened for a couple of years, so I felt a little bit better about it. I reached out. First, I checked their website, and I couldn't believe that there was a three-day convention where people could play and experience and test and play test all kinds of different tabletop games, role-playing games, but also just cooperative, fun, rules light things that you could sit down and do for 2 hours.
Right.
For 3 days long, I felt a little bit ashamed. Like I had been in the comics cave for so long that I hadn't looked around in the other places where my people might be.
Oh.
And so you posted this thing and I was like, well, this must be new. Oh, it's not new.
It kind of is, though, because there was a convention. Like, we had a gaming convention for a while called GymCon that ran, I believe, in the same place that this one is in. And it was, again, similar kind of a thing. But, again, it stopped running. This is pre-pandemic. And I believe Gametoba at least had one or two conventions before the pandemic, before all that stuff came out. So they did run a couple times. And great people. Like, I've just known them through, you know, doing Fan Quest and being involved in other things and seeing them at events. They've been an icon and other things as well. And they're just awesome because they show up. I had them at Fan Quest. They show up. They've got a ton of games. They got so many games. And they'll just show up and you can play whatever you want. And they'll explain the rules to you. They'll play it with you. They'll play through. These guys just love tabletop games so much. They'll just play for hours. And they would keep going if you didn't make them stop.
And shout out to Amusing Games and to Game Night, both shops in the city, which Gametoba made a point during the event a number of times of thanking them for donating so many games to their. They have what's called the Vault. And so anytime someone wants to, when there's an open table space, they can go to the Vault. They can borrow one of the games that's there and take it for a test drive with a group of friends or a group of complete strangers, which is one of the things I most want to talk about, I think, about my experience at Gametoba. So a little context for the dear listener. We mostly talk about comics. We mostly talk about movies and things. I've hinted at the role-playing game aspect of my secret other lives. But my relationship with tabletop gaming, i.e. Dungeons & Dragons and things like that, goes all the way back to my grade 7, grade 6, grade 7 transition year. It's a big year when you're a kid. What the dear listener and what Dan, producer Dan, might not know is that I lived outside of the city and I spent a lot of time with my dear friend Stuart, and his parents had horses and they would go horseback riding all the time. And occasionally we would muck about that way too. But one day they came back from a horseback ride and they said, someone threw this out of a moving vehicle. And so we picked it up because we were pissed off that they were throwing trash into the ditch, as one might imagine. And it was a whole bunch of 8.5 by 11 heavy cardstock cards that had weird titles like, you know, Serpent of the Dungeon or Tomb of the Necromancer. And each card had kind of this story to it. Now, keep in mind, I had never heard of Dungeons & Dragons. I didn't even know such a thing existed. And so what we discovered was this bag full of role-playing game stuff. But neither Stuart's parents nor we knew about it or had been playing or knew anything about it.
Okay.
And so they said, why don't you guys take this? This looks like the stuff you're into. You're always reading fantasy novels. You're always reading all this stuff. We were D&D adjacent in our entire
upbringing. You didn't know it was there, but it was,
it was ripe for us.
Right.
Right. And so I took these cards home. I want to really reiterate here. I'm on the top of my bunk bed reading through these cards that seem like...
You said 8.5 by 11, so like the size of a paper? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cardstock, and it was a map on one side, and on the flip side, it was like room-by-room descriptions of like monsters and things that would happen if PCs, which I didn't know was player characters, it was all abbreviations, right? Yeah. And it had stuff for armor class, I didn't know it then, and Thaco, to hit armor class zero for those initiates of second edition D&D. It were these one-page adventure sheets, but not knowing any of that, to me, it was like the production notes for a novel or a video game.
Sure.
Unproduced.
Yeah. I just want to know, just to pause for a second, I just want to know what the circumstances were that led to that bag of cards thrown out. I'm like, what, were they having an argument? Is it somebody get angry? You spent too much time with this stuff. Get it out of here.
Remember, the 80s, satanic panic.
Ah, yes, that's true.
There was a big push to say that using your imagination, you know, that's not how they characterized it, but, you know, they said that, and that they, in this case, being religious pundits.
The moral majority.
Yeah,
right?
Saying that games like Dungeons & Dragons open up children to the idea of monsters and devils, and once they know what a devil is, then a devil can reach them.
Mm.
And so then they'll be manipulated by Satan.
That's true. So yeah, somebody was upset that they found this in their kid's room
and threw it out
the window. Yes, okay, well, at least it found a home.
Right? It did find a home. So whichever parent took that from their kids, thank you, because you started a lifelong obsession with using my imagination.
Yeah.
And so I went through reading these cards, like just poring over them, trying to figure out what they were. Now remember, no internet.
Yeah.
Right? No message boards, no nothing. And so Stuart and I would talk on the phone and be like, what do you think this means? What do you think that is? And it was then that, and in those days, things had their copyright information printed on them very carefully. And so you would read and try to figure out what this was. And the copyright information, as I recall, was to TSR, right? And that didn't mean anything to us. Couldn't Google it either.
Nope.
And so we didn't know what these things were, but man, did we want to know.
Yeah.
Right? Man, did we want to know. And then Stuart ended up bringing it to his cousin, who was like, oh, this is D&D stuff. Here, I'll lend you a bunch of books. And we didn't know still about any of this. Summer is about to roll around. So Stuart's going away for the summer. I'm going away for the summer. And he says, here, take this book. He gives me a player's handbook. Right? And a second edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons player's handbook. And he says, you read this one. You'll play. When we get back from summer break, I'll read this one, the DM guide, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and we'll figure out what to do.
Yes, I told you it could be done.
You have the power of the immortals. You can control dragons.
Back in those days, I often would spend the entire summer out at the cabin, basically alone.
Right?
My parents were there, and they were great parents, but when you're a kid, you're just in your own head. And so reading this book cover to cover and imagining what it's all going to be like, and it would make reference to what was in the Dungeon Master's Guide, of which I had no access to.
Yeah.
And so it was just all this potential energy building up all summer, building characters and figuring out stuff until, at long last, we got together and used our imaginations, and man, did we get it so wrong. When we actually met people who knew what they were doing, it was
you guys made up your own rules to D&D.
100%. That's awesome. We were just trying to interpret bad writing, you know, not bad, but best to the best of our ability, bad understanding,
right,
and pretty complicated writing. Rules have come a long way.
Yeah.
Explaining that kind of stuff. So it started essentially an obsession where at least once a week, if not more often, from grade 7 until like now, we've gotten together with a group of friends or sometimes online now and run regular sessions. And my desire to design games and make my own games has not rested. It just hasn't slid into the public sphere. I've designed probably at this point 20 or 30 different role-playing game systems. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
None of which were, to me, the thing I was looking for.
Yeah, I played one of them, though.
You played a version, yes. Yeah. And now we are at a place where the one that I know works with young kids, old kids, university, literary snobs, video game, never read a books, right? Everyone gets it. Everyone understands the rules really quickly. And I was really happy to then be in a position just by chance, by calendar, to have enough copies of our playtest editions of Danger in the Details to then, when I was booking Gametoba, one of the things they said was, we don't have any vendor spaces left, but if you want to run a table, sponsor a table, and run games the whole weekend as a local game designer, you could. Which, to me, was like, wait. So, basically, I would run role-playing games 3 days straight. Yes. And you guys will organize the schedule. Yes. And people will, using an app, pick when they're going to come. Yes. And all I have to do is write a little description, a little tag of what's going to happen in those two-hour slots. Yes. And you're going to organize all of it, right? If they were like, that's what we do. That's what the convention is. Dan, I had such a good time.
Oh, that's awesome.
I wrote a story arc description that basically described the complete collapse of civilization at the hands of elder gods in a two-hour... in two-hour little episodes, set in Midnight City, which is a setting inside Danger of the Details, at least the core book, where I brought one there for you to look at.
Yeah, so this is like based on Midnight City, which is like a previous
that's the graphic novel properly. Series that I did.
So yes. You could like say that's the source material for this?
It's my version. So the way I think of it as Midnight City is the story I wrote using these same ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Right? So somebody else could write a different story using
completely
the same ingredients.
Different.
Okay.
Yeah, yep. Completely different. And so the first 100 pages of it are just characters, weird characters, weird heroes from a faux 1920s to 1940s kind of pulp era.
The Heap.
Yeah. Some of them are like The Heap, straight from the public domain. The Heap was the character that... inspired Swamp Thing and Man Thing.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And some are complete original characters of mine that I just kind of snuck in because they felt really pulpy. And others are adaptations of other pulp characters that have kind of been updated or altered. And then there are also hundreds of pages of settings and monsters. And it's basically a gigantic notebook. And the way the rules work, very simply, is that players add details to certain scenes and the narrator adds details to certain scenes. And when both groups have enough details in the scene to make it worthwhile, you roll these dice, which is the danger dice, and then determine what happens as a result. So it made it very simple for young, old, like I said, all varieties of people who popped by Gametoba and said, hey, do you have space at the table? I'd say yes. They're like, okay, because normally I have to book. And I'm like, well, we had four people, but if you want to pull up two more chairs, jump in. How long does it take to make a character? 3 minutes. How long does it take to participate in the game? As soon as you sit down, you're in it. And so it was a really wild ride for me to watch complete strangers meet each other, become a cohesive group, tell a story that had a beginning, middle, and end, all within a little hour and a half time slot, and then stay connected for the whole Gametoba and then come back and say, hey, we want to play another chapter with those characters. Hey, we want to do something else.
That's pretty cool.
This one guy came and he was like, you know, I loved the way my guy died in the last one. He set it all up so that his character would have this dramatic, horrific death.
Yeah.
And when he came back, he's like, I want to play. Is it okay if I play again? Absolutely. Who are you thinking of playing? He's like, I want to play And his character, by the way, he played this character called the Clock.
Okay.
And the Clock had this magical pocket watch. It could freeze time. Was killed horribly in the previous chapter. He said, I want to play the coroner that finds that magic watch and is now the new Clock. Trying to find his way, trying to be a new hero. He played this grizzled old veteran hero.
So he continued
hero,
the story.
And
that's
then he
interesting.
Continued his own story. With,
yeah.
And so there was all these things that I just would not have, could never have planned for, based completely on the types of people who sat down to just try something totally new. I haven't laughed that hard and that long for a good while, Dan.
Wow.
And I have Game of Toba to thank for that and the organizers of that, because they made such a great event where people just came and felt so free to meet strangers and sit down and just have a shared experience. And I think part of it was that, even though I'm not big on like really careful, organized, slotted, you know, minutes associated, the app, what it did was it gave people the freedom to not have to ask if there was a spot they could book it,
mm-hmm.
not have to have the awkward like, introduction moment of like, oh, I'd like to play with you guys, all that stuff.
Can I play, guys?
Right, all the stuff that adults find very challenging without a drink most times.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Was all offloaded onto the app. They book their spot.
What's the app called? Do you remember?
They just had it built into their website.
Oh, okay. Like, so they cool. So
maybe
this is Game
app
of Toba.
Is the wrong description. I apologize, Game of Toba, but their website functioned very well to okay. allow you to book where you were, when you were,
but on your phone, right? You're using
right.
This, yeah. So mobile app. Excellent. Yeah. Perfect.
And so I was new to Game of Toba, but there were some old veterans there. So as soon as I got there, someone told me like, hey, yeah, I'm here for the session. I was like, oh. And then three other people showed up and said, yeah, I'm here for your session. I was like, oh, how does that work? I did not know.
Mm.
But it was so well organized that I didn't need to know. When I asked them, everyone who knew was like, oh, yeah, here, let me show you. I'll walk you through all the steps. And the organizers did the same thing. They're like, look, you can see every hour how many people have booked, and you know, if you want to block one out, if you feel like overdone, you have the power as the person running your table to say, I need a lunch break or I need a whatever.
Oh.
You can like swipe it from the calendar. I didn't. I was having too much fun.
Yeah.
How
many sessions did you do?
I basically ran, I felt like 15-year-old Greg. I basically ran a session from Friday at like 4 o'clock. And ran sessions nonstop till Sunday at 4 o'clock. And the Game of Toba goes till midnight on Saturday and Friday. So like right to midnight, go to sleep. I just, my cup runneth over with just creativity and good times and laughs. And even if people were not all the way invested, the fact that they were only there for a short time meant they went all in, even if it wasn't their thing. And one guy who just absolutely blew us all away, he was using voices, he had the plot all figured out, he held space for this little kid that came to the table who also wanted to be, he kept like throwing great ideas towards him so that the kid could like pick it up and like carry it. At the end of the session, he says, that was my first time ever playing a tabletop role-playing game. And like the entire table was like, come on, you're a ringer. What are you talking about? He's like, no, I've never been to Game of Toba. I saw a website. I thought it'd be fun to meet new people. And he was, you know, it was wild to see adults with just the thinnest framework say, ah, here's a safe place to use my imagination.
Especially now after the what everything we've been through, I've found that interacting in real life has not been great. Right?
I know.
Right? We're still kind of weird. We're still kind of like figuring things out or getting back to quote unquote normal, as they say. So that's great to hear that event came together that well. And everyone just kind of showed up and bought into what they're doing and just said, okay, let's have fun and play games all weekend.
Yeah.
Right.
And one of the, for people who are interested, who are maybe a local designer or have like a secret card game that they've been developing or designing, if you book a designer table, like host the table for the weekend, then you're allowed to sell your games and your stuff from that table between sessions. So it also turned out to be pretty good that people who wanted to, you know, the copies that I brought, I sold out of completely. In fact, I had to hold on to a set so that I had enough to play with people who were interested. And then at the end, I said, you know, whatever I have left, people can come back. I didn't think anyone would come for a tattered old copy after like 3 days of people flipping through it, but they showed up.
Make it easy on yourself. Give me what is mine.
It was a humbling and character-building experience, no pun intended, to be at an event that was so honestly organized with the user in mind. It was so great. There wasn't like all these upsells or all these chase items or all this other stuff. There was just what it was, what it advertised to be is what you got. And if you showed up with that in mind, that's what was there. And all the volunteers were there to make it happen. And when people won a game, the other thing they had at Game of Toba, which I have not seen before, maybe this is a common thing at game conventions, so I apologize if I'm just the new guy with the stars in his eyes. When people would win, they also had a wall where they would go and take people's photos with the person who ran the game or with the game in their hands, and then they would all get entered into this big draw. They had a huge raffle of like games and stuff, which didn't cost people any more money to be involved in. They could just, if they were playing, and once in a while they would win, or a kind DM would just bring everybody up so that they could get their photo. They'd all get entered into the raffle, and then that gave people a further reason to stay to the end, because then, you know,
they call it the draw the name. Yeah, that's great. That's a great idea. I love it. It sounds like just a bunch of great ideas coming together in an excellent event.
Yeah, and it didn't bite off more than it could chew, at least not from the outside. Like, because it was running pretty smoothly from a new guy who showed up, who didn't know how it was supposed to run. The first volunteer they paired me with, they said, hey, this person's going to show you the ropes. He'll walk you around the whole event. He'll tell you how it all works, and then he'll bring you to your table. And that's exactly what happened. He knew where everything was, how it all worked, why it all worked, showed me where the table was, said if you had any questions, and then checked back later.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah.
To see if, you know, you got it figured out. So Game of Toba won my heart, Dan.
Nice. Yeah. Well, it's great to hear. I mean, and so this is now officially in a released game that you sell and that you are out on the market now?
So, yeah. If someone is interested to look at, they can, if they Google Danger in the Details, Midnight City, they'll probably find the Amazon link is where the easiest place to get it is right now. We're working on a deal with a couple of stores. This is something that is primarily, though, a tool, the Danger in the Details game. There's Danger in the Details, Midnight City, and then I have a Fairy Tale Ending one and a Moon Patrol. I'm using it mostly with schools right now.
This is not suitable for children.
Well, the Danger in the Details one is definitely, what's the word I would say? Parental guidance.
Why? What's in there that's not suitable for
the
children?
The main image in there that I think makes it not suitable for children is there's an autopsy image.
Oh, okay.
Where there's an open body with like a plant growing out of it. The kind of thing that if you're in grade one, you probably don't want to see. You can't unsee things.
Right.
And so I usually target it for teenagers plus. Yeah. But I will say a bunch of 10-year-olds showed up to Game of Toba and were like keen to play it. And their mom was there with them. And I said, okay, so mom, I'm going to tell you what page to turn to. You're going to look. The kids aren't going to look yet. And you're going to tell me where this lands on the rating scale for you
as
to how I will set the scenes for the adventure that we're about to have. And she was like, oh, this is the kind of thing you could describe, but I'd rather they not see, is how she put it. So it felt
good.
But then the other thing that happens is as soon as you put a little funny, not suitable for children tag on something, which I basically, it's a copy, like it's a scan of an old public domain comic where it was labeled the same way during the panic that happened in the 50s about, do comics make people evil?
Right. First it was comics, then it was D&D later on.
Right? So this panic is like, I find hilarious. So my reason for putting this not suitable for children in the exact font, it's literally a copy of that old sticker on the cover of mine, is kind of an F you to that entire idea. Because, yes, there are things kids shouldn't see or be exposed to out of context. But in context, you can almost handle anything.
Sure.
Right.
I would also say that also says to me that it's not suitable for children, which means it is suitable for me.
That's right.
That's what that conveys. Yeah. So that means that it's not for kids, it's for grown-ups, and that's just fine by me.
Right. The other side of it too, which was funny to see at Game of Toba, is nothing makes kids want to look at something more than that little sticker on it. So,
for sure. What is it? They want to go right to the page and know exactly what it is you don't want them to see.
But with the Moon Patrol version of Danger in the Details, it's all robots and monsters, and there's nothing, there's no human shape that has been injured in an illustration. And so it's a lot easier to take that into middle schools. Right?
So you could do this like with any of your properties, really. You could do like a Imagination Manifesto version and that kind of stuff.
Well, on the docket right now next are, for me, Automatic Age. I mean, a complete automatic age set.
Yeah.
And then I have a Sword and Sorcery one related to our shared world stuff that I'm going to put together. And then a revamp of the Fairy Tale ending one, which with everything we learned from Moon Patrol and the Midnight City, I'm just going to do a redesign. And we've tested the game as a structure, as a just straight up role-playing game. 3 to 5 people, you know, a couple hours a night kind of scenario. I've done it with about maybe 20, 25 different groups of playtesters. But what they all had in common was they knew each other before they tested the game with me. So Game of Tobo is this wonderful thing where nobody knew each other.
Yeah.
Right? And then they also were trying to learn new rules together as strangers. And to me, that was the real test of whether or not the new rules were short enough, concise enough, and direct enough that people who didn't know each other and therefore don't really have time, right, could get it, grasp it,
right,
and get on with it. So I would set these timers, unbeknownst to my players, that if we weren't up and running within 7 minutes, I consider myself a failure.
Okay.
Right? And I was batting about 50-50 by the end of Game of Toba, right? Usually it would take about 10 or 15 minutes, but I wanted to really get people in under 7 minutes. And then the other thing I did at Game of Toba, which it turned out to be, I think, a good thing. I didn't tell people I had written it, illustrated it, or designed it when I was running it for them. So they sat down thinking that they were booking a person who was hosting a table and running a game that they hadn't made.
Oh, okay.
Right?
I guess that would make sense, right? That's usually how it's done?
Well,
I assume so?
That's usually how it's done, so that's what people figured.
Yeah.
And I think what that gave me was a lot more honest feedback.
Okay. So they don't worry about hurting your feelings.
That's
as much.
Right, because they're like, oh, we're going to try. And I would say, like, okay, we're going to try this game. These are how the rules are. And I would occasionally refer to the rules that I had written out, you know. And so it didn't look like a person who knew everything. It looked like a person who was following the ingredients.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
So.
And as a result, people...
Little bird.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. What Dan is doing is he's looking through...
I'm looking for things to make fun of. But that's just like Robin.
Right?
It's just Robin.
That Robin character is literally in there as a plot device. It's like, do you need a dead sidekick?
There
Here's
you go.
Your page.
There you go. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so very cool. I really like this. I like this idea. And this is like, this didn't exist when I played this version
of
it.
No, not at all. No.
Well, a couple years ago, I guess it was at this point.
Many of the art assets did exist, much of the pieces. But what I was playing with, again, no pun intended, but what we were playing with was the idea of a narrative-based game where the rules are very strict, but the limits are non-existent. And what that does is it gives the narrator and the players a sense of what I can and cannot do, given the turn that we're all taking together.
Mm-hmm.
How do I pay attention to the other players? How do I use what they're doing to get the most out of what I'm doing? In game design, at least in tabletop games, you've probably heard the term min-maxing.
Yeah.
Where like you just take the best armor and you take the best class and you try to do the most damage, you make sure your rolls. It basically eliminates min-maxing as a thing that you can do yourself. The only way to min-max is to pay attention to what other people are doing, and by using their details, you will get a bonus, but they will also receive that bonus as a result of you paying attention to what they're doing.
We should play this on the podcast.
I would love to.
Yeah, let's figure out how to do that. So we'll do that.
I would love to.
All right. Cool.
Now, you've been up to something.
I have, yeah. I've got a Meat House update. I was worried.
That was the other thing I was going to say.
What?
You asked what's on the docket. The Automatic Age is on the docket for Danger in the Details. My Sword and Sorcery one. And a horror movie, 13 Horrors collection.
Oh, nice.
It's also on my list of things to do by 2024. Is to have a complete, like a brainstorm your own horror movie book.
Not so talented, eh, Mr. Ridley? I've enjoyed our little chat, but now it's your time to die.
I don't know why I'm scared of Justin more than you, but he feels like he's really holding me accountable. It's like he was really going to be upset if I don't
you know
my
what?
Deadlines.
Because he's being held accountable. And that's what happens with stress, Dan.
Is that right?
Yeah, you bottle it up and you deliver it to the person. You He's under stress.
Right.
Of deadline.
He's transferring that stress to others.
And so he's now handing it to you.
Yeah.
But also transmuting into something useful.
Yeah.
Right? I feel the stress. I'm going to motivate Dan with the stress I feel.
And that's motivating me because it does. Like, as soon as I think of, oh, crap, I'm going to record the podcast, I have to have something. I have to have something to tell him.
That's right.
So I write out, just now it's for 3 pages, I wrote out, I mean, this is in the notebook, so two,
okay, let me describe
pages.
To the dear listener. Dan took out of his
book. Oh, yeah, this, we lost this
yeah,
this
a little
episode.
6x9 notebook. In the front of it is a drawing, which I believe his daughter
My daughter did, yeah. She did a concept art for the story.
If you see a previous episode here, a previous episode that we did with Steven Kostanski called The Meat House, you can see where the origin of this idea came from. And Dan has decided that he is going to undertake to write a full script and treatment of this concept. And we've been holding him accountable for that.
So what I have new this week is I have 9 scenes outlined as far as like what happens in them. Just little blurbs, very brief strokes as far as like, here's the main action in this scene. Here are the things that have to happen in order for the story to progress. So basically I have introduced all the characters, set up the scene. I'm not going to go through every detail. And at this point, I've got them discovering the room. You remember we talked about a room. Mm. The red room is one way it's referred to in a lot of horror movies. But the room, they have to find where all the secrets are, all the things are. Basically, I've got them to that point.
You got them
now.
To the mystery box.
Yes, I've got them there. Scene 9, they're exploring the room. So that's really where I am. Maybe halfway through. I don't know. It depends on how long these scenes are. But I feel pretty good about that. I feel like that's a good, solid beginning. I could probably write the first scene right now if I just sat down in front of a computer because I have all the dialogue and stuff and exactly what I want to happen.
You ever dictate?
No, I've been trying to, I've been thinking about that. Do you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's great.
How does that work? What do you do?
Well, a few years back, it was awful.
Okay, yeah. But the technology's gotten a lot better,
Oh my goodness, it's so much better. And so, for the dear listener also, I've been teaching an after-school program online to a group of, well, it's like 80, some days it's 85 kids, where we do essentially the rules of danger and the details. They just don't know that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. It's called The Classroom Story, and we're building narrative and story structure all the time. I lost the thread. Where was I going?
You're talking about class after school, and I don't know where you're going with that.
There was a reason I brought this up. There was a real clear reason, and before, if I had drank this cappuccino before we started the podcast,
that's okay.
I'd be right there with you, was what I was getting at. Oh, structure, maybe that was it?
Sure.
Maybe story structure. Oh, that's why. There's a feature on the MS Teams that we're using that lets it transcribe.
Oh, yes, we're talking about that. That's right.
The audio.
Yes.
And so we turn on the transcribed audio, and it's 80% there. Right? Yeah. It doesn't have the best vocabulary, and it tries. And if you're using anything from mythology or from cross-cultural references, it completely loses it.
Okay.
But if you're just doing straight dialogue, that's what we're talking about.
Dave. Yeah, I was thinking about
that. That was the thread I lost, was the use of technology and narrative and transcripts. And that's why I brought that up. Because when I look back at 2 hours of teaching through my transcripts, it's fantastic. And when I sometimes am on a long walk from the studio to home, I will just talk into my phone the dialogue that I have to write when I get home.
So you just act out both sides of the conversation.
That's right. Just act out both sides of the conversation. And then it goes into my notes function as a basically crappy first draft.
Yeah.
And then I copy it from my notes function into my word processing and then clean it up.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So I had recent experience with this when I was writing a story about transit, the Winnipeg buses. You know, obviously, not just Winnipeg, it's all kinds of cities that... Bad things are happening on the bus right now.
Yeah.
It's in bad shape. And so I interviewed a professor from Simon Fraser University who's an expert in transit police and talking about security on buses. And it was a great interview, but it was really dense. It was like 20 minutes of this guy talking straight. And I'm like, oh my God, there's so much here. I usually transcribe myself. I usually actually listen and type out everything. I know.
Yeah.
It's exhausting because usually my interviews are only like 5 minutes long and it's not a big deal. But for that kind of thing, I'm like, oh, I got to transcribe it. I can't sit there. So I looked at all these different services that offer this up and they're all expensive, really overly expensive, I think, and complicated. But then I noticed that Word, the new version of Word, has it.
Yeah.
So you can actually take an MP3 of this conversation, upload it to Word, and it will just transcribe the whole thing in there. And that's awesome.
The same way that websites are Now, I'll try not to get derailed by the thought of technology in our narrative like I did the last time. But this time I got it clear. QR codes.
Yeah.
If you look up how to make a QR code, you only get hundreds of websites that charge you for QR codes.
Right.
But if you go into Chrome and you just click on the right-hand side, there's a little widget there. It'll just give you one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's free. So
everyone wants to charge you for it.
Yeah, but all they're charging you for is your ignorance.
Yes.
Right? So those same transcription services are charging you for their ignorance. You think they aren't putting it into Word and then sending it back
to
you?
Well, I actually think that other companies have forced Word to top its game.
Right.
I'm noticing this with the Grammar Checker as well. It's way better than it was a couple of years ago. Grammarly has forced them to do that. So anyway, that being said, I have thought about doing that, especially for the dialogue. If I can visualize a scene in my head and just want to act it out, I could do that and just dictate the dialogue. So I will try that, and I'll let you know how that goes. So yeah, that's a great idea.
You know what's nice about it too is, at least what I found, is if I have a character that I think of as thoughtful, right? What I'll tend to do is think about what they're saying and put all these unnatural pauses in because I want them to be thoughtful, so I'm thinking more carefully.
Okay.
It doesn't record that really. It just puts the words there with all that nonsense and fade. And so when I then go back and see the transcript of someone that it took me 10 minutes to think about what they would have said in as a quippy response.
Yeah.
It really reads as a quippy response. I'm like, oh, wow, that character is really clever, right? It's like 10 minutes of Gregory processing compressed into this character's single bite of voice.
You don't like that, do you? Good. I could use every ounce of your rage.
I did this morning before I came to work. So I need to set aside some dedicated time
to
actually
write. You codified it this morning.
Yes.
You've been thinking about it a lot.
Yeah, I have been thinking about it a lot. Again, I think that first scene, I could just write it out right now. And I know exactly what would happen. The more I think it through, the more clear it becomes. Now, I can see the danger in this is that I've been thinking so much about the beginning of this thing. I have not thought enough about the ending.
But
of
you
it.
Know the end. You've described the
I
end
do
to
know
us
the
a
ending.
Number of times.
Yes, yes. What I just you know how do, to, don't know how to get there.
Don't worry about how to get there. Write down the ending. So a real problem that I think a lot of writers have when they're starting out is they feel like the ending is some kind of quest they have to reach before they're allowed to write it down.
Okay.
That's
nonsense. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, they can't get there until they write everything else.
Right. Nonsense.
That's true.
Yeah, write the ending down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then figure out the connective tissue. And if an idea occurs to you and you say to yourself, oh, I'm not there yet when I sat down to write, you're not going to come back again. Write it down. You're there on the ground looking at it. Your imagination gave you the gold. Dig it up. Put it aside. Fine. Figure out what order it goes in later.
Yeah. So what I did here is I started with this and I wrote opening scene and then I went scene two, scene three, scene four. But what I really should do is skip ahead and go closing scene.
Yeah.
Or like it won't be the closing scene, right? It'll be the concluding, like the conclusion of the action rather. And that's another thing is I'm not following any of that kind of stuff, although I am aware of things like the story circle and that kind of thing. That's... I'm not thinking of that. I'm just kind of thinking this through as it comes to me. And I think because I've seen so many movies and I'm so aware of this stuff, it just kind of is coming naturally.
Dan Harmon's story wheel, the hero's journey, you know, Joseph Campbell, Save the Cat, all this stuff. These are tools of distillation. They're not tools of creation.
Right.
Right.
Just so, to help you get in the right frame mindset.
No, but this is what I'm saying. They're tools of distillation. You have to have something before you can distill it down to fit around the story wheel.
Yeah,
you have to have something before you can distill it down to fit the Save the Cat, right? You have to have something.
I'm not familiar with Save the Cat.
So just gather, right? The point here, right, is just gather the ingredients.
Okay.
Right? Before you try to distill it, you have to have the ingredients. You know?
I'm going to write that down.
You have to go out. Okay, so I come from a long line of non-medicinal, I will stress, mushroom pickers.
Okay, right? Thanks
My
for stressing that.
Grandmother, we're not out there looking for psilocybin. We're just looking for mushrooms for our stew, right? And first you go out and you have to get what we call in the family mushroom eyes. Now, my wife, Tara, turns them on instantly, mushroom eyes. right? Which is the ability to look through the forest floor and scan for a very specific shade and shape and spot that thing amid literally tens of thousands of objects that look similar.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get your mushroom eyes, that's still no guarantee that the mushroom is edible or even the mushroom you're looking for. But first you have to get your mushroom eyes. Then you fill up the receptacle with all the mushrooms that you're gathering. You're pretty sure, because you know what you're looking for, that they're all right. But you don't then just wash them and put them in the stew. You could die, right? You could. It would be bad. Then you carefully go through each one. You cut off the base. You cut them in half. You check them for, you know, parasites and all this kind of stuff. And the rule in our family is if you're not 110% certain, you throw it away, right? So all of that is that process of distillation. We still haven't started cooking yet.
Okay.
Then you look at the recipe. Do you have everything you need for the recipe? If you do, then start cooking.
Okay.
But don't tell yourself, you don't go into the woods holding the recipe.
No, it's not. It's right.
Right? So this is what I'm trying to say to you is avoid those things because they're tools of distillation. They're not tools of creation.
Well, right? I am avoiding them. And again, I'm feeling pretty good about where I am. So I'll report back. I'll let you know where I'm at next time.
I look forward to that. Now, this is all on my mind because, of course, the danger and the detail stuff is about a distillation of storytelling process. That's the basic rules. It fits onto one sheet of paper, which was what's taken me 15 years, basically, of refining, is I've told myself, and I don't know where I even got this idea, Dan, but now that I've told the story of that stuff in the ditch,
yeah,
maybe that's where it came from. I convinced myself that if it couldn't fit on one piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, the rules were no good.
Because you had that example to start with.
And
on
I
the cards.
Just am now realizing it. Thank you for this therapy session I'm just now realizing where that obsession came from.
Yeah.
It's because like a whole world opened for me.
Right. On one card. On I mean, you had multiple cards, but there was like each one represented a new world, right?
A new world. Yeah. A new world. And so this idea of the blank piece of paper, you're writing a screenplay, right? That's the form. But story is the medium here. And if you're going to find elements to go into your story, don't worry about where they come from or why they occurred to you, or even if you're lifting it from someone else in that first draft feeling. When you're distilling it down, you'll shave away everything that wasn't yours. You'll shave away all the parasites. You'll shave away all the stuff. You'll start to follow ingredients. And by the way, if we use that ingredients analogy, the cooking analogy, there are lots of different recipe books. Right,
true.
Because there are a lot of different tastes out there. And you'll find the one that you think best suits the kind of storytelling. And when we first brainstormed Meat House in that first hour, the idea is what stuck with you, not the recipe we had set.
True. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Well, I think, that sounds good. Cool.
What else are we going to talk about, Dan?
I think we're done. We almost, it's 45 minutes, I think. So we're
that
doing
was pretty good. Okay, so if we talk about,
is there anything else you want to, what's coming up next or whatever?
Well, what I spent the afternoon working on was a cover for the new Laundryman.
Oh, yes.
Kickstarter, because Stephen Call and Lyndon Rochanka started their Laundryman Kickstarter. And I thought, like most Kickstarters, they would be slow out the gate. And I had told them, I'll do a cover for you as a stretch goal. But I was like, I got weeks before you're going to hit that stretch goal. Boom! 2 days later, it's like yes.
Congrats, guys.
If they unlock one more stretch goal, then I have to have given them work that I didn't think really they would need for 2 weeks. So hats off to them. The Laundryman is a really cool project, really great comic. You can back it on Kickstarter depending on when this comes out.
I mean, funded, but it's still funded very quickly, but also get your copy while you can, right?
Yeah, because I think this is, and it's their stories to tell, but there's a lot of cool things happening behind the scenes as a result of Laundryman that I think is just a real testament to like making stuff up, putting it down, and once it exists, just like we were talking about, then you can show it to people and make something of it.
Yeah.
So.
Cool.
Well, that's new. What's new for me? This has been Super Pulp Science, encouraging you that if you throw your children's role-playing game stuff out of for fear that Satan himself has inculcated himself into your family life, make sure you put it in a waterproof bag so that the next person that finds it can have a sure fun time and perhaps start an entire lifetime of storytelling. This has been Super Pulp Science. I'm Gregory Kamichuk, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics or games or movies.